Have you ever tried to balance justice and mercy? Hello, this is Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas, your host, and I begin today with the same question I asked last week because I am here with my conversation partners once more, Daryl Bigger and Brant Berglund, both colleagues from the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, and we ended last week kind of running out of time talking about how in the restoration process that God is engineering on this planet, working to restore what was lost by the fall, that the two key components seem to be justice and mercy. And we were talking last week, and we continue this week, about how difficult it is to do that sometime. And we were looking, actually, I think last week, at some provisions in Genesis, and we had mentioned Isaiah, that it is particularly offensive to God if you read those passages in the Old Testament. And the Hebrew prophets, by the way, the ancient prophets get very exercised over this, is that what happens to your worship if you are being unfair and unjust elsewhere? Any thoughts on that?
Isaiah 58, he continues that theme when he speaks about the Sabbath and about days of fasting. And he says, when you oppress the poor, when you strike with wicked fists, this isn't the day that I have called a day of the Lord, a holy day, and yet this is what you're doing on your fast days and on your Sabbath days. He says you ought to call these days days of delight, where you help others. And yeah, the prophets found that the main sins of Israel were those where they didn't take care of the underprivileged.
Mm-hmm. Or those who are downtrodden. And mm-hmm. You know, when you think of poverty, I think about that. I used to think that poverty was a result of laziness. But I was very glad many years ago when one of my professors pointed out that actually there are many poor people who work harder than rich people. It's just that they are caught in a cycle of poverty that they cannot escape. And some of it is their circumstance, but some of it is the way other people treat them. And what many of them need more than a handout is an opportunity. You know, they need an opportunity to actually do something and make a difference. And here I want to take a moment and recognize my own maternal grandmother, who is now dead a number of years. But she lived in Africa and hired a woman who was cross-eyed, a young African woman who was cross-eyed. In that particular culture at that time, I don't know how it is now, but this was 60 or 70 years ago, this woman was believed to have been cursed, and therefore she would have no social place in her own culture. She would never be married. She would always be ostracized because her eyes, were not, she was cross-eyed. And my grandmother took her in, gave her a place to live. She had a home, an apartment, so to speak. My grandparents were storekeepers, and they had an apartment on the back of the store, and this woman lived there for years. My grandmother taught her how to cook and took her as she became the cook of they had a whole encampment there, but she became the cook, and she lived a respectable, profitable life where she earned a wage. She lived there happily for many, many years, and I've often thought to myself, what if my grandmother had never done that, you know? How different would that person's life have been? And I'm very impressed by that kind of thing. Yeah. Don't mistreat the poor.
That's an excellent point and a wonderful story, Dave. I haven't heard you tell that before. It is true that there are some, take it away from just the poor, but who end up in circumstances that are difficult for one reason or another. There are some for whom that is the natural consequence of very poor choices they have made.
Yes.
And to the degree,
that their parents made.
Well,
sometimes.
That's correct. So does one distinguish between two groups of people, some of whom are simply enduring the consequences of their bad choices, and those who by circumstance haven't had opportunity to do anything better?
Well, I'm looking to you for the answer to that question, Daryl. My inclination is I would be much more, personally, I'd be much more inclined to help
yes.
the people who who are suffering because of other people's poor choices than those who not that I would exclude the other ones, but I think I would find more energy to help somebody who is caught in circumstances they didn't create than somebody who did.
We would, wouldn't we? And every parent knows that one of the struggles between mercy and justice is deciding which consequences your child at different stages of life is capable of experiencing in order to learn to avoid that behavior in the future.
And so is the formative question, what would be most restorative, since we're talking about restoration, as a parent or maybe even as a judge? Shouldn't the foundational question be, which action can I take of those available to me that would have the most restorative effect on this, not the most punitive effect? Because, you know, we become immune to punishment at some point. We become calloused by it, see?
Well, we have to ask also, and we don't always have the answers, I think, but we also have to ask, what does the restoration of God look like? Well, does it come simply by having more money and having more goods? We speak of poverty. That assumes that we have a level at which we can judge whether somebody has a certain level or not. But then sometimes I look at my own life, and you know, I have lived a very comfortable, I think, North American life, but I'm definitely not wealthy. And I wonder sometimes, if I had more money, would I be better off? I think the answer in many ways would be no. In fact, there's times when I've thought if I had less, I might learn some better lessons. So when I think about restoration, I can't say that just restoration of finances then answers all the problems, because it can sometimes create more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, in my experience, just giving people things is not usually a good solution, you know. By the way, I wanted to ask a question last week, and it's egging me on. I'm going to throw it in here, even though it's a little out of context. What happens when the powerful pervert justice? Have you ever thought about that? What happens when the powerful bend the forces, the instruments of justice, to their own purposes? Wow.
They lose the loyalty of their followers, don't they?
Yeah, but they create havoc upon the powerless people, too.
You bet.
Yeah.
It sows the seeds of revolution.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, I hadn't thought that far. That's pretty scary. So, hey, I want to shift here back to Ezekiel 47, verses 1 through 8, in the official lesson guide, if any of you have looked that up on Google. This is a major feature, and it's interesting there because in verse 9, it talks about a river, a stream that is flowing, that attracts or engenders life for a whole swarm of living creatures that live in and near the river. And as one who has been rafting a number of times in my life down the Deschutes River here in Oregon, you know, it's in a very dry, arid country, except for the first 4 or 5 feet from the edge of the water. It's green, there's grass and all that kind of stuff, and then it's barren. And so when I read this about a stream that attracts living creatures that live in and near it, I kind of projected on that, what if Christians and Christian churches were like a stream that allowed people to thrive and live well? I don't know, does that do anything in your minds?
Does for me. Isn't that what the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs that are connected with religious institutions, are exactly attempting to live out, to create an environment that demonstrates what mercy is about, that gives some of the results of positive justice, and gives people a chance to be reclaimed?
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, it does intrigue me how some people, when they get an opportunity like that, they jump at it and they go and they make it. It makes a big difference. Other people squander it, you know.
And is that not what reclamation is all about? It's giving people opportunity to learn by life choices and experiences how to decide so well and to treat their resources so well that they can make progress instead of destroy themselves.
Yeah. But that forces me to ask a question then, Daryl, about the church or the community of believers, wherever they may be. What is our role in being part of that work? I'm not always sure we have good answers.
But is this the time to talk about
that?
Yeah. I'm very intrigued with an increasing emphasis, at least in our own denomination and in other denominations too, on finding ways to make tangible benefit possible for broad groups of people. even outside our own sub-circles. We exist to carry the good news of who God is in this world, and the rivers in the desert do that.
Yeah. And I'm intrigued, you know, the Christian church takes a lot of heat today for a lot of reasons, but I'm also intrigued at how many universities were started by Christians for the purpose of educating the masses, how many hospitals were started for caring for the poor. Mm-hmm. I know in Africa where AIDS is rampant that most of the care of AIDS patients comes from Christian communities. You know, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, these are all things that have been very much a part of the Christian ethos, epitomized perhaps most grandly in Mother Teresa.
Sure.
But, I want us to end. We have only a few minutes here, but Brant, maybe you can look up Amos 5, verses 21 to 24. And I want you, if you find that right off here, I want you to read those verses to us because they are rather scathing. And you can read Amos 5, verse 21 to 24. You can read it in a gentle voice, not in a prophetic voice.
So Amos 5 and verses 21 through 24.
Yeah.
I despise your feast days. I do not savor your sacred assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them, nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings. Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. But let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Now, here's an interesting thing, because here the believing community of that day was caught up in all the right rituals and doing all the things, fulfilling the obligations to God, but they were neglecting the stranger and the widow and the poor. And this is a pretty scathing rebuke. I'd like to hear it in Amos's voice, but I wouldn't dare I wouldn't try and mimic it. What does that tell us today?
It reminds me of Jesus crying when he looks out over Jerusalem. I like the quiet and approach and imagine God weeping in sadness.
Yeah.
And maybe
we don't
we'll
see
there.
The connection. We miss the connection.
We do often, and maybe we'll get there, but Matthew 23 says the same thing. Jesus says, you've tithed, but you've neglected justice and mercy, the weightier matters of the law.
You know, I ask myself a question. I ask you. Have you ever thought what you would say to your Savior one day if you made it a practice of being hard and cheap in your dealings with those who are downtrodden? That to me, I had to settle that long time ago in my mind because I lived near a freeway where people stopped at my church and I decided not to investigate but to take them at their word and buy them food and gas, never large amounts, but anyway, it's a challenging thing that sometimes as religious people we get caught up in our policies and our protocols and we allow our favoritism of those to obscure the bigger things. So, anyway, thank you, gentlemen, for your participation today. It's energizing and interesting. My thanks to David Olson, our engineer, and my thanks to those of you for listening for The Good Word. I'm David Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.